A very different political convention for an unprecedented time in the U.S., but has this week's big political event moved the needle in the Lone Star State? That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. As the Democratic National Convention moves into its final night, a look at the role of Texas, or the relative lack thereof, and whether the event could change the calculus in November. Also, remembering Ann Richards' big convention moment and the significance of how she said what she did. Also, an epic battle in the online gaming world that's more than just a game. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 20th day of August, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. If you tuned into the Democratic National Convention proceedings last night, you may have noticed the parade of prominent women in the spotlight, from vice presidential pick Kamala Harris to Gabrielle Giffords, Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton, and many others. No mere coincidence in a week marking the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. Issues ranging from immigration and gun violence to subsidized child care, universal health care, and paid parental leave shared the virtual stage, alongside memorable speeches like those of the 44th president, who, through what many described as what appeared to be tear-filled eyes, laid out what he saw as the stakes for November, a case against his successor that was both withering and yet optimistic. But what was supposed to be the highlight of the evening, the historic acceptance speech of the first African-American and South Asian-American woman nominated as vice president by a major national party in the U.S., was not bathed in cheers as one would expect on night three of a national convention. The dynamics of a pandemic-altered event changed the dynamics of that moment, as it has the rest of this event. And for Democrats, especially many in Texas, who see this election season as potentially historic for Texas and the nation at large, a question remains on this fourth and final day of the DNC convention. What's changed, and has it moved them closer to victory? Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is an assistant dean for civic engagement and a lecturer at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, and she joins us now. Welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks so much, David.
Would you care to weigh in on what you saw as the highlight of the convention, if not on night three so far, these first three nights?
Well, let me start with last night and then zoom out for the bigger picture. You know, last night was undoubtedly a ladies' night. Here we saw not just the descriptive representation of women, of these strong leaders, but also the substantive representation of the issues that matter most to women. We're talking about gun violence. We're talking about childcare. We're talking about education. So for me, that was very satisfying to see that spotlight on women and women's issues. Zooming out, you know, a virtual convention is not like a real convention, and I'm a convention junkie. I love the moment every 4 years when you go to the conventions and the energy. It's not there, but I think there are some good tidbits to pull out. You know, maybe in the future we'll see more of a hybrid feature where you can connect more people in, but still get some of that energy that you get with folks being in person. Putting on my Texas hat, I'm frustrated, David. I got to tell you.
Frustrated? Why that?
You know, I'm not seeing the presence that one would think would be there in a state that's moving toward that battleground-ish territory. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that we had Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro, who, you know, made a really good run at the presidency. And, you know, speaking of Julian, he also shares the role of being one of the most prominent Latino former elected officials, and we didn't see that voice. So I felt a void, you know, not to take away from Colin Allred and Victoria Neve, who I thought did a fantastic job, you know, in the rising star spotlight. But mm-hmm. I just did not see much there in terms of a Texan presence. And if they think that Texas is moving in that direction, I would have liked to see them put a little bit more emphasis on that.
One of the issues that's been prominent over the last certainly 3 years and many, many more, as anyone who follows the news knows, immigration here in Texas. And there was a very stirring testimonial offered by an 11-year-old girl. Did you happen to catch that?
I did. And I mean, and this is the thing about immigration, that it's such an intensely emotional issue. And it's always been that. Immigration is ultimately about families and the life course of folks. But under the Trump administration, immigration has taken a much harsher turn, and one where we've seen children separated from their parents, where we've seen children put into cages. So whereas immigration always has elicited strong emotions, now it's fever pitch.
Question, has the Democrats' message been in some way watered down by the format of this event, do you think? Or strengthened? I mean, you know, you could make an argument for either one.
I think the intensity of in-person events, there's no substitute for that. So on that side, yes, that's just our new reality. But on the other hand, the positives of our new reality, and I'm also speaking as an educator where my classes are going to be online and I do, you know, Zoom lectures and talks where you're reaching a lot more people. And once we get past this moment where we're just constrained to the virtual format, figuring out what that right recipe is for the balance of technology and in-person event.
On balance, do you think that the convention has moved the needle, or is there something they need to do tonight or that you would expect tonight?
David, to be honest, I think conventions rarely move the needle. You do see post-convention bumps here or there, but at the end of the day, it is the long, hard work of the campaigning and, you know, the folks going out and delivering their message in a more consistent way. This is a good jump-off point, but I don't think it's the decisive point.
Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is Assistant Dean for Civic Engagement and a lecturer at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks again for speaking with us.
Anytime, David.
The Trump administration's been aggressively pushing for a border wall through Webb and Zapata counties in South Texas. A coalition of landowners and activists have been voicing their opposition for over a year and decided to make their message clear last weekend in downtown Laredo. Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez has the story.
With tape and buckets of yellow paint in tow, volunteers in face masks outline letters in the street in front of Laredo's federal courthouse. Longtime resident and artist Antonio Briones tells me the city's art scene isn't usually political.
This has never been done here in Laredo. We are making history here right now, as we speak.
The threat of the border wall, he says, motivated the No Border Wall Coalition to take a bold stand with a 30-foot tall street mural. Letters the same height as the proposed wall.
And as you can see right now, everybody's moving, everybody's doing something.
Briones gestures to at least two dozen people busy at work.
All these people right here care about that wall coming to Laredo.
Project organizer Gian Galan says the inspiration came from recent Black Lives Matter street murals.
We didn't want to just say what we were against, we also wanted to talk about what we're for. And that's why the message in this mural is not just defund the wall, it's fund our future.
It wasn't enough to say stop the wall.
Trisha Cortez directs the Rio Grande International Study Center and is a leader in the South Texas Coalition Against the Wall.
We wanted to send a huge national message, and we knew these street murals were a beautiful way to involve a lot of people in the community to send a really strong message to Washington.
The Trump administration has already announced two contracts for border wall construction in the area, with a price tag of more than $500 million. A lot of money, Cortez says, especially when you consider some 29% of Laredoans live below the poverty line.
We learned that 1 mile of wall could fund a major trauma center for adult and pediatric care for 3 years. And these are the kinds of things that we need.
Ultimately, Cortez says the coalition wants that money reinvested in the city of Laredo. That sentiment is just part of what brought out at least 100 volunteers through the weekend. Early on, I meet local artist Shelly Laron, outlining the first D in Defund the Wall.
Let me just catch my breath, sorry.
Yeah, for sure. No.
We've been at it all day.
She says she's braved the triple-digit heat because of her immigrant roots.
My mom is from Guatemala. She made the long trek with her family to come here for a better life, to contribute and succeed like everyone else. So for me, I feel that the wall represents division.
Lauren says the walls caused division with her relatives too.
I have people in my own family on my father's side that are supporters of Trump, and they're Hispanic and they agree with the wall, and it's unfortunate. It's disappointing to see it. We don't have arguments, but we definitely have debates. And it makes me sad, but I respect their opinions and they respect mine.
But she tells me when it comes to the mural, some people have been hostile.
I've seen it on Facebook. I've gotten hate messages.
Getting to this point wasn't without controversy either. The Laredo City Council first unanimously approved the mural project in July. But backlash prompted them to discuss it again and re-vote, before giving organizers a green light this month. Now the city council's drafting a street painting permit process that it says will give other groups the same opportunity to voice their opinions. As volunteers painted on Saturday, a truck with a Trump flag drove by and honked. Volunteers just laughed it off. After two long days of work, the mural was nearly finished by Saturday evening. Organizer Trisha Cortez called it a message of hope.
For our people, the whole border, and the whole country, that the government can't go in and do whatever they want without the will of the people.
Painters celebrated by gathering in the street around the words Fund Our Future and chanting. Cortez says they plan to maintain the street mural until the wall is defunded. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar has been monitoring the talk of Texas on this Thursday. Hello again, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the Democratic National Convention. Via Facebook, Ihor Gauda says that Kamala Harris did well and Obama just slayed. About those remarks from the former president, Josh Fredman has this extended comment. President Obama's definitely the best speaker of our time, but this speech was different from his usual fare. He gave a really dark speech about democracy withering and controlling interests in this country, tearing down the nation. 12 years ago, he ran to restore America. This speech was about saving America, Josh writes, and for the first time, he allowed himself to express a measure of his vast frustration at the American people for failing to live up to our civic obligations. However, Marcus Sengupta wasn't swayed. He writes, everything that comes from the Democrats is do what we tell you or people are going to die. The sky is always falling. Just some of the remarks we're seeing out there about that remarkable evening of programming from the Democrats. I'll have more from social media later in the show.
You know he will. We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard or reach out to us on your social media platform of choice. It appears the governor has announced that the state is applying for an additional $300 a week in jobless benefits for those who lost employment due to COVID-19. One of many stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard, and there's more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
On the latest episode of Vamos Verde, we did a very unscientific poll during the first three episodes, and we found that two out of three players cannot stand Danny Pereira. Why? We find out. We talk to Danny about it. Plus, Austin FC superstitions and why fans even follow them. That's all in the latest episode of Vamos Verde from KUT and KUTX Studios. Find it and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Business and Your Money on the Standard, I'm David Brown. Home ownership, job opportunity, and access to health care. Many immigrants across Texas are struggling with all three. As KERA's Alejandra Martinez reports, a new study maps out these problems for Dallas, and now city leaders hope to do something about it.
A quarter of the people who live in the city of Dallas are immigrants, which is why Professor Ruth Wassum thinks the city should focus on being more inclusive.
Immigrant incorporation takes time, and whether we have equity also hinges in general on whether we have equity across all people in the society.
Wassum is with the University of Texas at Austin. She led a study focusing on how Dallas immigrants are struggling to find affordable housing and getting trapped in low-wage jobs.
We did a lot of asset mapping of where things are in Dallas and where things are in relation to the neighborhoods that are immigrant rich. So we found some areas where there's going to need to be some improvement.
The study looked at neighborhoods like Oak Cliff and Vickery Meadow. Both have a higher unemployment rate than the city as a whole. Liz Cedillo Pereira is a chief of equity and inclusion for the city of Dallas. She says she will use the report findings to make improvements.
It just gives us a lot more understanding of the nuances that will be required to tweak our current policies, because it is a lot more than just putting a name on a sticker and saying you're welcoming.
The study recommends city leaders provide more language and job training and create more options for affordable housing. I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Right now, there is an epic battle brewing online. The combatants, Epic Games, creator of the wildly popular Fortnite, and Apple, the world's first $2 trillion company and maker of the iPhone and the App Store, from which every app, including Fortnite, you might want to use on that iPhone, must be downloaded. Apple takes a 30% cut of any purchases players make within the game, and in most other apps too. But Epic has a problem with that. Here to provide some color commentary on this fight is our tech expert, Omar Gayaga. Welcome, Omar. Good to talk with you.
Hey, David, ready to get real geeky here? A lot of geeky stuff happening.
Here we go. Well, you know, I think a lot of households are familiar with Fortnite. You don't have to play the game to have heard your daughter or son talk about it. It's free, but Epic Games and Apple both make money when players buy things inside the game. Can you tell us a little bit about the economics of mobile video games like Fortnite?
Yeah, this is what's called a free-to-play game. You can download it and play it all you want, but if you want to start buying costumes or kind of dances or emojis or things within the game that are like virtual items, then you have to download some currency, and people pay for some of this with real money. So where do you get the real money? That's the big kind of crux here is, do you buy it from Epic on their website? Do you like leave your phone if you're playing on your phone and go buy it from them, or do you buy it through the App Store? If you buy it through the App Store, then Apple takes a 30% cut of what's called the V-Bucks, and you know they keep that money. So at issue here is Epic, the company behind Fortnite, decided to discount the V-Bucks and say, you know, if you buy them directly from us, you know, you're going to get a discount. And Apple shut that down real fast. Ooh. They did not like that. So that is kind of the issue here, is them sort of trying to subvert that 30% fee from Apple and now turning it into a bigger fight about that the fee itself is unfair and that other people in the industry should join the fight against Apple.
Now, it's my understanding that Apple banned Fortnite from its App Store, which is a pretty big step to take, because Epic took the big step of sort of going public with what it considered to be sort of monopolistic practices on the part of Apple. Tell us a little bit about that and how Apple's responded.
Yeah, Apple kicked them out of the App Store, and Google did the same with its Google Play Store, kind of following suit. But what's interesting is that this feels very orchestrated by Epic. This feels like they had a plan to, they knew they were going to get kicked out of the App Store. They knew that was what was going to happen. So they had a kind of propaganda video ready to go along with this. They had a whole kind of full court press to kind of get the word out of what was happening. So this feels like a very intentional kind of battle that Epic wanted to drag Apple into, not something where Apple was responding, you know, surprisingly. They knew this was going to happen. So this is about Apple feeling like, you know, we're big enough to take on Apple on this issue, and other people probably feel the same as we do as far as other developers.
Interesting. You talk about that video. They were sort of riffing on Apple's own 1984 video, the Epic, pardon that use of that phrase, Super Bowl ad that they ran in which the woman comes running down and smashes the screen, right? What did Apple have to say about it?
I mean, first of all, just the video is pure propaganda, and is probably lost on a lot of the young audience that wasn't around for the 1984 video. But still, this shows that Epic put a lot of thought and effort into kind of waging this battle. Apple responded by saying, we make no exceptions. You know, you're going to change your app or you're going to be out of the App Store. And then this extends into other Epic products, you know, on the Mac. So Apple can shut those down as well, can say, you know, you're not going to be able to put out any software on the Mac platform as well. So this could have further implications. Seems a bit disingenuous on Apple's side, though, because they have made exceptions on that fee for other big companies like, say, Amazon.
Well, how does this play into the fight? Why doesn't Epic get a discount?
You know, that's a very good question, because like on the video streaming side, Apple has kind of found ways to kind of get around that for the people they really want on the platform. For a long time, you couldn't do Amazon Prime Video through Apple TV or through its phones. But Apple found a kind of a creative agreement so that people could purchase movies and things like that. So there, it seems like Apple is willing to work with certain companies when it wants to, when it serves their needs, like say on the video streaming side. But in this case, I think Epic just decided, you know, we're just going to take them head on instead of trying to work something out.
So what's going to happen next in this Clash of Titans?
Well, Epic has filed suit against Apple on this, and but it's really not looking good for Apple when they say, you know, we make no exceptions, but you can clearly find exceptions that they have made in the past. So Epic, I think, has a pretty good case, and a lot of it, I think, will depend on public reaction, will depend on how concerned is Apple that these antitrust issues are going to hurt it, you know, in a bigger way than just this game. So I think Epic has a very strong case here, and Apple should be a little bit worried.
Watch this space. Omar Gayaga is certainly keeping an eye on the tech world over at techminutetexas.com. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David. Appreciate it.
Looping back to politics for just a moment, the Texas Democratic Party wants to force several Green Party candidates off the November ballot. The Texas Tribune reporting that a Travis County district judge has sided with Dems, blocking several Green Party candidates from high-profile races from appearing on the November ballot, including those running for U.S. Senate and the 21st Congressional District. Now, that race, we note, is the district where Wendy Davis is challenging incumbent Chip Roy. In addition, the Austin-based Third Court of Appeals has also removed a Green Party candidate for Railroad Commissioner from the ballot. Texas Dems say they're going after the candidates because of unpaid filing fees. It's a new requirement put in place last year for third parties. Green Party officials say those fees are an unconstitutional burden, and they've said they won't pay them until their legal challenge to the law is resolved. We'll keep you posted. More of what's making news across Texas in the Texas Roundup, and that's just around the corner as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Governor Greg Abbott is directing the Texas Workforce Commission to apply for additional unemployment benefit funding made available through a recent executive order from President Trump. If approved, out-of-work Texans will get an extra $300 per week. University of Texas System employees and students are asking the Board of Regents to suspend most in-person classes and provide more resources to protect against COVID-19. This morning, the board heard from people who've drafted a petition for sweeping changes as the fall semester approaches. UT employee Vera Belcher said that includes more compensation for staff.
The university should immediately issue hazard pay of $500 a month for each essential worker. UT can't afford to take care of its employees right now, and it is a time when so many are more vulnerable than ever.
The petition also demands in-person classes with more than 10 students be moved online until coronavirus cases sustain a downward trend. Note, the staff of KUT in Austin, including the anchor and editor of this newscast, are UT Austin employees. Texas Democrats are demanding Congress fully fund the U.S. Postal Service ahead of the November general election, when an influx of people are expected to vote by mail. That includes Congressman Vicente Gonzalez of McAllen. He says it's not enough that the Postmaster General is suspending operational changes until after the election.
So we are working to assure that our operations are at 100%, that we don't have any problems moving into this next election, and that people could continue receiving, obviously, their meds, their Social Security checks, their disability checks.
The U.S. House is expected to vote Saturday on $25 billion in relief funding for the Postal Service. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner is pushing back against critics who say he has a history of ignoring recommendations from task forces he's created to address major concerns within the city. That includes the Housing Stability Task Force, which unanimously recommended an eviction grace period for renters affected by the coronavirus pandemic, but Turner has so far refused to implement it.
Look, in this business, you're not going to please everyone, and if you try, you're going to miss the boat. You call a ball, and a strike. And just because I don't do what you want me to do doesn't mean that what I'm doing is wrong. So this is a tough business, and these are tough situations.
Turner's comments Wednesday come after the Houston Chronicle reported on task force members frustrated with his lack of action on their recommendations. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, and it is time once again for a segment we call
Texan.
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 Translation.
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 Texan.
Translation.
Wherein we explore the state's linguistic landscape with Lars Henricks. He's a professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, and he is the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks, David.
Okay, so the circumstances are a bit different from normal, but we are nonetheless in the thick of convention season in this 2020 election cycle, and I understand we have a topic today to match. Is that right?
That's right. We're going to look at a speech given by a Texan at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. Hmm. And we're going to start with just the very first line. I bet most listeners are going to know who this is pretty quickly.
Well, let's listen.
I'm delighted to be here with you this evening, because after listening to George Bush all these years, I figured you needed to know what a real Texas accent sounds like.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, that was Governor Ann Richards, I do believe, Texas's most recent Democratic governor.
That's right, although at the time she gave this speech, she wasn't the governor yet. She was state treasurer.
Ah, yeah, right. So this was something of an introduction for her, at least at a national level, right?
That's right, yes. And her Texas accent is easy to pick up here, clearly. She doesn't sound a whole lot like most of her audience, which is a national TV audience, after all. But we want to look at how she uses that to drive home the message of her speech.
Okay, well, let's hear this next clip. I understand she's going to be talking a little bit about growing up in a small town in Central Texas.
I can still hear the sound of the dominoes clicking on the marble slab my daddy had found for a tabletop. I can still hear the laughter of the men telling jokes you weren't supposed to hear, talking about how big that old buck deer was, laughing about Mama putting Clorox in the well when the frog fell in. They talked about war and Washington and what this country needed. They talked straight talk. And it came from people who were living their lives as best they could.
Wow. So what do you take away from that soliloquy, Professor?
So first of all, clearly, of course, this is an identifiable Texas accent, just like she announced right at the beginning of the speech. So she has a sound, she says sound, and for found, she says found. So there is no mistaking the accent and the sort of cultural identity. This is kind of typical for politicians. Politicians often use vernacular speech when they address the public, but normally they do that intentionally to their constituents to show I'm one of you, I speak like you, and so I'm one of you. And in the same move, she sort of discounts the Bush's authenticity because they didn't really fully grow up in Texas. What we have here is slightly different. She's really addressing the whole country and making herself intentionally distinct. The message here is more, we can be the way we are, but we're still Americans. And, you know, out of many, one, we can be different and yet be one country.
And a sort of a nuanced message, too, because you think about the history of the way that many people from the American South tried to modify their accent so that they would, quote unquote, blend in with a lot of people up north, especially when there became a lot of, you know, job migration and travel and that sort of thing. Well, let's hear a little bit more of Richard's speech.
We've been told that the interests of the South and the Southwest are not the same interests as the North and the Northeast. They pit one group against the other. They've divided this country. And in our isolation, we think government isn't going to help us.
Huh. She's saying we it's not how we talk, it's what we're talking about.
Yes, that's right. In a way, she's saying this style of speech is superficial. It remains consistent, by the way. She says South and divided and isolation. The premise of her speech is many Americans have been forgotten and left behind. And really, that means they have the same worries no matter where they're from. They have similar needs, they have a shared humanity, and they need a government that recognizes that.
Lars Henricks is an associate professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor Henricks, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
The first episode of Season 5 of Pause Play is out now. This season is all about change. Climate change, changes in laws, changes in ticketing. How are these things impacting Austin music? In this episode, we look at how COVID changed how we feel about live music. Plus, we do an overview of Season 1. You can find Pause Play on KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Terry Williams. I am an author of Jim Baucus's Preschool Day. I am an educator. I work with preschoolers and want to recognize my rainbow students. I work with kids that are 4 years old and I prepare them for kindergarten. Something that I teach my preschoolers, I teach them how to make a book with construction paper. And I introduced them to writing their own story because they are authors. And another thing we do in school is we journal write. We have opportunity to go in their journals, write a story made up or something that they experience. And I showed them that letters combine and mix words. So, and I tell them what I'm writing as I'm writing it. And when they share it with me, it becomes my story. Basically, how I started out is I started writing down stuff in a notebook, and I thought about my son when he was younger. Jamarcus is my son's middle name, and I started writing about some of the things that we experienced. He was a little nervous. I was a little nervous because, you know, new teacher, new friends, new school.
When he arrives at school with his mom, Jamarcus becomes sad because he knows that it is time to say goodbye to his mother. They walk inside the building and are greeted by his teacher and friends.
Mommy, don't leave me. I want to go with you.
Mommy reminds Jamarcus she has to go to work. She says, "You will learn so much at school and have an amazing time with your friends. Give me one more hug and kiss, and I'll count to three, and I'll hand you over to Miss Johnson." So, as a parent, I wish I had this, you know, before my son started preschool, but I've heard this saying that if you don't see books that represent you, write them. Again, the name is Jamarcus's Preschool Day by Terry Williams, and you're listening to The Texas Standard.
Coming up on 43 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, I'm David Brown. A chance meeting between two lovers of music ended up with something that neither of them alone could create. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan has the story of two very different crafts and the craftsmen behind them.
40-something craftsman and furniture maker Frank Straza shows me around his shop in Bandera, filled with projects, with wood, and with tools.
Okay, that's it. So then I'll just take a plane and plane it all flush.
In the course of about 5 minutes, he had taken two 1x4 pieces and made a beautiful dovetail joint for me.
Okay.
Early on in life, he felt a calling.
By the time I was 12 years old, I knew I wanted to be a furniture maker.
His first serious project sold him on the idea.
I had built a hand-cut dovetailed blanket chest for my parents. They still have that at the foot of their bed.
Straza had the chance to study carpentry in the European tradition right here in Texas.
When I was 17, I had a great opportunity to do an apprenticeship, and I apprenticed with a craftsman outside of Austin.
After the apprenticeship came a journeymanship.
A journeyman would go on to study with a different craftsman to maybe learn a different way, a different style of working.
Studying under two different craftsmen gave him an exceptional baseline skill onto which he's built for the last 30 years.
It takes a lot of hard work. Obviously, having that good foundational training is superb, but then there's the time spent at the bench behind the tools with the materials.
Just as he hit the ground running as a wood craftsman, he got another itch.
Right about the same time that I started my apprenticeship, I started getting interested in playing the cello.
Yeah, that's a cello, but no, that's not Frank Straza. That's Ken Freudigman.
Yeah, I'm the principal cellist of the San Antonio Symphony. I've been there since 2005. I'm also the artistic director of Camerata San Antonio, a chamber group that has been performing in San Antonio since 2003.
As a college student, Freudigman was experiencing his own kind of apprenticeship at downtown Rochester, New York's Eastman School of Music. Over his time there, something emerged in Freudigman's mind about the curious inequality of musical solos. Most instruments could elevate their sound above the rest of the orchestra.
The piano is up off the floor. The violinists stand when they play, or if there's a trumpet solo, they're all up.
Cellists, though, have to play sitting. But there at Eastman, he heard there might be a solution.
We heard that there were designs for a cello podium, not just a box, but a cello podium that actually had a sounding board and a sound post.
Those elusive designs, though, just couldn't be found.
So I forgot about it for 20 years.
But then fate tossed him the first curve.
I was searching on the internet, and I found this place called the Catgut Society.
The Catgut Society is a group of people who play acoustic stringed instruments.
And I was looking in there, and sure enough, the plans were there.
He resolved then and there to get it done.
Someday, I would love to have this built.
Then years later, fate tossed him another curve. After performing with his group Camerata San Antonio, he met Frank Straza. Finding out Straza was a wood craftsman, well, that was it.
And I sent him the plans, and he just jumped at the chance, and he thought this would be a great idea.
This cello podium was unique in the sense that it's an actually acoustic podium in its nature. It's essentially an acoustic amplifier.
Strasser reminds us, music is made up of sound waves, and every acoustic musical instrument is designed to produce them. That big piece of wood that's the front of a guitar is made to vibrate and push the sound generated by the string.
So what I did with this cello podium is I actually took the inside. I made a soundboard similar to like a guitar, but I actually curved it to simulate the arching of a cello or a violin.
So he built Freudigmann a cello podium about 5.5 by 3.5 feet and not quite a foot tall. It's something to see.
When you look at this thing, they're all hand-cut dovetails. I mean, it is a work of art. And not only that, it sounds amazing.
The vibrations can hit inside of that curved soundboard and then project out through the front and then also the sides. And I made the whole podium out of curly maple, which again is a traditionally an instrument maker's tone wood.
Imagine the odds against this. A cellist needs an incredibly specific to cello piece of furniture, and the craftsman who presents himself to do it is himself a cellist.
The serendipity of it all was amazing. I mean, I suppose I could have found anyone to do it, but Frank is a world-class woodworker.
Strasser got to build it as a craftsman, but then he got to try it out. As a cellist.
As a cellist myself, that I found what was really exhilarating about it is the feedback of the vibrations that I got through my feet coming back. It makes me actually want to go back and try it again, but take my shoes off and just play barefoot.
Strasser's cello podium has been used by the San Antonio Symphony, Youth Orchestras of San Antonio, and more recently, he's built one for the Oklahoma Philharmonic. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. And this is what enhancing awareness of COVID-19 sounds like.
This whole coronavirus craziness is going to be over before we know it. But we must social distance, 6 feet apart, and wear our masks, and wash your hands, buddies. We're going to beat this thing!
That is a clip from Parker James' TikTok account. The North Texan is a social media influencer. The video that clip came from has been viewed over 1 million times. And even though it may sound a bit different from the public service announcements you're accustomed to, that's basically what it is. The Texas Department of State Health Services is spending over $6 million to partner with influencers like Parker to get the word out on how to stay safe during the pandemic, specifically for teenagers and young adults. The big question, of course, is will it actually work? Here to help us get some answers is Corey Bash. She is a professor and the department chair of public health at William Patterson University in New Jersey. Professor Bash, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
$6 million is a lot of money. You've researched the effect of using social media to spread public health info like this. What evidence are you aware of that spending that kind of money to recruit TikTok influencers is a sound investment?
Well, at this point, it's very early in the game. Very few studies have been done on TikTok specifically to tell whether TikTok will be effective in spreading the messages. But I think what cannot be overlooked is the impressive and widespread reach that this platform has. It has escalated in popularity, especially among the age groups that you're mentioning, and is approaching 1 billion users worldwide. So this and other social media outlets have widespread reach, and that's really the significance of this effort.
I guess that gets at a larger question about communication theory, doesn't it? I mean, obviously TikTok videos are getting a lot of views, but the question is whether or not there's evidence that those views actually influence behavior in some way.
Time will tell, but we've seen They're called influences for a reason. They influence people and their decisions and their behaviors. And while in some cases we've seen this work negatively, I do have confidence that it could work in a positive fashion as well. And not only that, but then they pass that on. They share those images, they share those videos, and it becomes a real collective effect.
Can you think of a way or a time at which public health information was spread virally? Pardon the pun. I mean, is there a reason or some kind of analogy that you can think of that might be a kind of way to understand why this might work over some more conventional models, like, say, the public service announcement?
I think we're catching the adolescents where they are. One of the tactics that public health professionals use is called social marketing. And so we borrow from traditional marketing strategies in which the intent was never to improve the health of the public. It was to sell a product targeting a certain age population on a certain venue that we knew they would have access to. So we could think about commercials for children using characters during their Sunday cartoons. Mm-hmm. I think we're catching them, the adolescents, where they are in a timely way with a person that they respect and they want to see. We're not looking at someone with a white lab coat explaining to us the scientific purpose behind wearing a mask, why it's important, why they should do this. We're engaging with someone that they want to see.
So overall, even though the research isn't complete when it comes to the use of TikTok as a platform for these media messages when it comes to public health, what's your sense about a $6 million spend on social media when it comes to the pandemic? You think it's a good move or no?
It's an important question, and it's somewhat abstract because it depends on a lot of factors. So we have to look at the quality of materials that are being created for the campaign and then measuring their success in reaching their audience. However, when the outcome that we're talking about is illness, spread of disease, and potentially death, I don't think you could even put a price tag on that. So if we're talking about saving lives, then absolutely it would be worth it. Will be a worthwhile endeavor.
Corey Hanna-Bash is a professor and the department chair of public health at William Patterson University in New Jersey. Professor Bash, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
And you are listening to The Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, what do you think about that idea, using social media influencers you think
if
that
someone
would work,
wants to slide me a check, I'm
behavior?
All about it.
So says the social media influencer himself.
Exactly.
Wells Dunbar.
I will tell you that video we heard the clip from earlier with that psychotically pitched voice, like the video is even weirder. So go check it out. We'll put up a link on TexasStandard.org there. Some breaking news going big on social media today. Former Trump campaign manager Steve Bannon has been arrested and charged with fraud for his role in raising money for a privately financed and Texas-built border wall. So this is in connection with this group called We Build the Wall. And apparently they pulled in over $25 million for the sort of crowdsourced border wall that they wanted to build along the Rio Grande River there. And apparently, despite claiming that 100% of the money would go toward the execution of this plan, apparently Steve Bannon received at least $1 million, according to charging documents, and used that to offset hundreds of thousands of dollars in personal expenses. And as for the wall that actually was built, I should note that ProPublica and the Texas Tribune, they recently reported that a swath of the wall built in connection with the project in Mission, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, it's actually in danger of falling into the river due to erosion. I think we've talked about that some on the show previously. Mm-hmm. So a heck of a story coming out today. Lots of our friends and listeners on Facebook taking note of it. Pat Houlihan has a really interesting take. He notes that the report says that he was arrested by the United States Postal Inspection Service. The post office cops arrested him. How strange is that irony? Obviously, with the issues surrounding the Postal Service making headlines and allegations of sabotage, essentially, right, of the Postal Service in connection with the upcoming election. So, yeah, and apparently arrested at sea on a boat by the postal cops. Huh. So quite an interesting development there.
That sounds rather interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. I was taking a look. According to the indictment, Bannon promised that 100% of the donated money mm-hmm. would be used for this wall project. But again, according to prosecutors, the defendants used hundreds of thousands of dollars in a manner inconsistent with those yeah. representations. Apparently, at least the indictment says that they faked invoices and there were sham vendor arrangements mm-hmm. To hide what was actually going on. It's my understanding that they originally promoted a project for about 3 miles of fence posts in South Texas that was ultimately built and mostly funded by Tommy Fisher, who's the CEO of Fisher Industries, one of these yeah. companies that got about $2 billion in funding.
Went on, yeah, to get a big, big contract there. So yeah. definitely one that we're going to be hearing about for a few more days and weeks to come.
You know it. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org, and we urge you to visit us there in the meantime. But we're going to be back here on the air tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.
Do brain games really make me smarter? What is all this screen time doing to my brain? How do I protect my brain as I age? Find the answers to life's most and least pressing questions about your mind with the Two Guys on Your Head podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.